If someone doesn't like me, fine. If they do, fine. It won't affect who I'll be or my self-assessment. Some people, when they meet a leader they view as more important, will stumble over their words. Instead of earning a new friend or making a business connection, they become fanboys or fangirls and turn that person off. One of Julia's moments of impact was during client negotiations. One of Sean's was account presentations. Early in my career, my moment of impact happened when I met with prospective clients. I felt like I stuttered and stumbled and came off as too indecisive and insecure to close the sale. Here are three everyday moments of impact. Use them as inspiration to find yours. If you'd like to get a more extensive breakdown across different worlds like sports, business, and personal life, go to alteregoeffect.com/MOI. Delivering presentations or speaking publicly. Sweaty palms, short breaths, nervous tics, and jumbled sentences greet countless people. They know they can't avoid having to give a presentation at a staff meeting, or they realize that to up their online business, they need to start hosting more webinars or training seminars. I work with quite a few people who struggle in this moment of impact, which, when they underperform, can significantly handicap their careers. You need to seem more than comfortable in the spotlight. People want to see public speakers who seem born to do this. This is true whether you find yourself in the corporate boardroom, on a stage at an event, or during a team meeting. I also see a variation of this when some people get so nervous or are so insecure, doubting, worrying, or judging, about their abilities and contributions that instead of sharing their thoughts and ideas in a meeting, they remain silent. Networking or meeting someone for the first time. Some people, when they walk into an event, become wallflowers. They only talk with the people they know, or they seem so uncomfortable that they come across as nervous and awkward. Other people kick into overdrive and zip around a room spitting business cards out to everyone who makes eye contact with them. I've worked with people who mow through an entire room, laying waste to it and missing real opportunities to connect with people in meaningful ways. Meeting and connecting with people remains one of the critical ways we grow our businesses and careers. Closing a sale. There are times when someone signals that they're ready to buy a product or service. Sadly, the seller is too busy following their sequence or process, so they miss him or her. They act like robots instead of displaying flexibility and behaving like a human. People can get hung up on asking someone else for money, and they end up fumbling with the conversation. They'll keep talking, and I've seen them unsell. Or they never close the sale because they come across as too insecure or too timid. What's your moment of impact? If you apply the five bridges of progress to the action layer, you'll want to apply these two elements of the framework. Stop doing, stop holding back, stop avoiding, stop behaving, and stop choosing. Or do less of, choose less of. Remember, the action layer contains your actions, reactions, behaviors, skills, and knowledge. It's all the capabilities you're bringing to your field of play. How are you showing up? How are you acting? How are you behaving? What choices are you making? If you pass all those questions over the bridges of stop and less of, you may find some key things preventing you from achieving what you want. This is about looking at the action layer of the field of play model to investigate how it might be affecting your results. Just like in your ordinary world, be clear with your answers. Be precise. Be descriptive about what's happening or not happening during your moment of impact. Remember, you're gathering all the data right now. Later, you'll build an alter ego who will show up in a different way, possibly the opposite way, from what's happening right now in your ordinary world. If you need to, go back to the last chapter and see what you wrote. You may have discovered your moment of impact when you described your ordinary world. Activate or stay trapped. Those are our only options. With the work you've just done, you may be getting a lot clearer about how you're going to be showing up on your field of play and the new results waiting for you. Why? Because to ensure we've explored your entire world, we're going to shine a light on what's been driving this performance or underperformance. Up until now, you've had this thing lurking in the shadows, preventing your heroic self with all your capabilities, skills, and talents from coming forth. It's operated and acted in the shadows, cloaked in secrecy, but not for much longer, because now it's time to shine a light on the enemy. Chapter 6. The Hidden Forces of the Enemy. The coach on the other end of the phone was getting more agitated and finally yelled into his phone, "She should be winning major championships, but instead, she blows these matches. She could be easily winning. I just don't get it." After talking to the coach for about 15 minutes, we agreed I'd be a good fit to become a part of the team. Rachel is an incredibly talented tennis player who handily dominates her opponents early in the match, but she struggles to hold on to the big leads and momentum she builds. To the armchair analyst, it would look like she loses all the gas in her tank and can't finish. Her play sputters out, and her opponents can often come from behind for the victory. When I met with Rachel for the first time, and I ran her through the mental game and performance assessment, it wasn't clear exactly why there was this conflict between what she was capable of and how she was performing. It only became clear because of a BLT sandwich. Rachel and I were sitting down at one of my favorite comfort food places in Manhattan, Penelope's, on the East Side. It's a tiny place with great food and one of the best BLTs you'll ever have. She was passing through New York for a media event, and we discussed her training, the upcoming season, and life in general. When the bill came, I reached for it, but she snatched quicker than the flap of a bee's wings. "This one's mine. You got the last one." "No, no, no," I said. "I invited you out for lunch. Those are the rules. The invited never has to pay. You can get the next one. It's only fair." Boom. It all clicked. This insignificant back and forth finally made all the puzzle pieces fit together. I explained this earlier, but it's such an important concept that I'm going to repeat it. We exist on multiple fields of play. The home field, the sports field, the friends field, the work career field, the hobby field, the health and wellness field, and so forth. On each of these fields, we're called to take on different roles. Each role has a different set of requirements. My dad role and my professional role are very different, just like my sporting role and my spouse role are different. Those are all different fields or stages you enter and perform on, and they demand different parts of yourself to show up and be great. We're showing up as different versions of ourselves all the time. This is natural, and it's human. Right now, you may be bringing a version of yourself with specific qualities and traits to your field of play and in a moment of impact that isn't serving you. It isn't positioning you to succeed, let alone live in an extraordinary world, which is where you'd love to be. So who or what is influencing this version of you showing up in the ordinary world? Inside the world of the alter ego effect, we call it the enemy. The enemy is a force creating inner conflict and stopping you from showing up as your heroic self. Since the beginning of time, humans have talked about this phenomenon. Carl Jung called this the shadow. In Star Wars, it was the dark side of the force. To mythologist Joseph Campbell, it was the dragons that needed slaying. I assure you, the enemy is nothing new, strange, or unnatural. It isn't something to hate or beat yourself up over, although we're typically very good at doing that to ourselves. Life is a duality. It's about opposites, light and dark, birth and death, up and down, inside and outside, day and night, yin and yang. The natural world is filled with duality, and you're a part of that natural order too. What you've been fighting, the enemy, is actually a natural part of how you're built. And oh, by the way, it has to be there. For there to be light, there has to be dark. For there to be up, there has to be down. For there to be the hero, there has to be the enemy. It's about balance. And while the enemy is a part of you, it's not you. The enemy is not only about the worry and judgment you fear from others. It's also a blending of certain beliefs and values and the specific traits, skills, capabilities, behaviors that are getting magnified and trapping you from taking the action you want. The enemy is the source of those unwanted behaviors and actions that I had you identify in the last chapter. Whether you're meek during a negotiation, whether you pass the ball or don't pass it enough, whether you refuse to volunteer to lead a project or say yes to too many things, That's the force of the enemy trapping you. The enemy is stealing your moment from you and keeping you tucked away, safe and sound, in the ordinary world. The common forces. The enemy hides in the shadows, pulling, twisting, and wielding what I call common forces. It creates a cascading effect of negative thoughts, emotions, and behaviors that impact and explain how and why we show up and underperform on our field of play or in a moment of impact. The common forces that can hold us back from achieving our goals are things like not controlling our emotions, lacking self-confidence, worrying about what others may think of us, doubting our abilities, taking more risks in life, not being intentional, a bad attitude. When you think back to the field of play model, the enemy likes to use these forces at any of the layers. Worrying and feeling anxious about your field of play and the people on it, your boss, your coach, your opponent, the market, home field, the pressure of the situation. Doubting whether you have the skills, abilities, resources, or grit to make it happen, to pull it off, to win. Lacking the self-confidence to show up and perform at your best, despite the fact you do have the skills. Concerning yourself with the risks of trying something new and possibly failing at it, even if it's a small step. You end up rationalizing that it's easier to play it safe because you won't get fired or cut from the team. However, your true self feels the sting of not taking the chance. Having a bad attitude can become a way to excuse yourself from trying harder, from overcoming the resistance, and fundamentally making yourself feel safe. Have you ever told yourself you don't need to practice today? That it's okay to be lazy today and you'll work twice as hard tomorrow? The only reason I call these common is that they're the forces you would most commonly talk about amongst friends, teammates, family, and peers. The example I gave about me punching someone on the volleyball court out of anger is a good example of not being able to control my emotions. There wasn't some deeper reason lurking in the shadows. It was just plain old immaturity and lack of emotional control. The simple fact that these are obvious forces doesn't make them any less troublesome. However, as you'll find out, an alter ego can more easily overcome these types of forces. The only common force I haven't mentioned yet is not being intentional. And that's because it's not often discussed. However, it is common to the lack of results most people are getting. The power of thinking in terms of fields of play allows you to be deliberate and intentional with who is showing up, which is one of the great benefits of having an alter ego. The problem that arises when someone isn't being intentional is that they can carry aspects of their personality onto the field of play that are not suited for the activity. I'll be getting deeper into this force throughout the audiobook as we create your alter ego. I'll also show you how it affected Rachel, the tennis player, later in the chapter. The human mind is a powerful factory able to produce any number of powerful images and emotions that can either help or hurt your cause. You're not ready for that promotion. You've never managed people before. Are you sure you want to spend that much on an investment property? That's a big risk, and you've only ever done smaller deals. Don't take the shot. What will everyone think if you miss it? Mary is a better chef than you, and even she doesn't have her own restaurant. Why do you think you'll be able to open a restaurant? You should probably let Charlie be the captain. He's a better leader. You're starting your business too late in life. You should have done this years ago. You missed your opportunity. You're not very good at doing sales pitches, so you'll probably have a tough time raising money. Your new marketing strategy sucks. Do any of these statements sound familiar? The enemy will use these worries, doubts, and confidence busters to prevent any chance of you showing up as you truly can. I worked with a basketball player who struggled to stop worrying about what his parents and the fans in the stands thought of his play. He became so wrapped up in what other people thought of him that he struggled to settle into a rhythm and made a lot of mistakes because his head wasn't in the game. The fact is, he's one of thousands I've seen worry about what others thought. As a CFO for a consulting firm, Karen's biggest struggle was giving presentations. As an executive, this was a major part of her job. it didn't matter that her information and analysis were on point, or that she's always one of the sharpest and brightest minds in the room, she doubted herself. The statement, "I can't give presentations," was a loop in her mind, before, during, and after the presentation. When she would stand before a group, her nerves and anxiety were visible. Her voice would sometimes crack, and when asked a question, she would stutter, stumble, and ramble in the most painful ways. She didn't just judge herself, she was also plagued by worries that other people were judging her, which created a vicious cycle that perpetuated the belief that she wasn't an excellent presenter. I found that most people have the skills and knowledge already available to them to transform their results. Karen did, and she found an alter ego to beat the enemy and step into being a great presenter. The enemy is sneakily using the forces to concoct a persuasive argument against you, preventing you from taking action, like starting that business or going after the promotion. By the way, I'm not advocating for people to pretend they have highly technical skills without doing the work. If you want to be a cardiothoracic surgeon, you need advanced degrees and years of schooling and experience before you're ready to step into that role. But when you do step into that role, you need to bring your A game 100% of the time. While those are the common forces that can slow you down or stop you, there are hidden forces that are harder to detect and can control your life like strings on a puppet. They come in the form of, number one, imposter syndrome. Number two, personal trauma. And number three, narratives. Hidden force one, imposter syndrome. When I started working with Dave, he'd already started and grown a thriving business selling software products. He had gained a significant amount of traction in the market, and he was ready to scale and expand. To do that, he needed to move into the corporate space where he had room to grow. He didn't have a steady enough cash flow to fund the next growth stage, so, for the first time, he was searching for investors, venture capitalists to be exact. With his track record of success, it was easy for him to land multiple meetings with some high-profile VCs. You would think that everything was aligned for Dave, and it was. Except, Dave wasn't aligned with Dave. Instead of swaggering into those meetings, he crept into them like a dog with its tail tucked between its legs. It's no shock to learn he wasn't getting the responses he had hoped for. That's when he came to me. After I had talked to Dave for a while, it became obvious he was a smart, competent, and accomplished person. However, Dave didn't see himself as accomplished. He basically dismissed away a lot of his achievements and hard work as luck, or right place, right time, and he plainly didn't believe he belonged with these other venture capitalists. What afflicted Dave is a force called imposter syndrome. Many high achievers and successful people struggle with it. If your enemy is throwing imposter syndrome at you, you can take some solace in the company you're keeping. People like Albert Einstein, Maya Angelou, John Steinbeck, and Tina Fey, to name a few, were or are all highly accomplished people who have spoken or written about feeling like a fraud. When the enemy rears up in the form of imposter syndrome, it will whisper a sinister narrative into your ear, spinning a story that your success is more about luck or serendipity or your genes than hard work. It causes people to dismiss their skills and capabilities or previous wins. Imposter syndrome is one of the most insidious little rots that can influence your behaviors and the actions you take on your field of play. Steve Jobs said, "You can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backward." This is what the enemy will do to explain away our achievements and success. It connects all the dots that came before in a logical sequence and spins a compelling narrative that downplays and dismisses our hard work and accomplishments. "Yeah, well, I was in the right place at the right time," the enemy will say. "Of course I won an award. I've been doing this a long time and it was inevitable. I'd be a loser if I didn't win something by now." Or the force of imposter syndrome will rationalize, "It's not that big a deal. A lot of other people have done it." There's just no owning any success you achieve and stacking it in your win column. The force just won't let it happen. What happens when imposter syndrome has you in its grip? You become terrified you'll be found out. Despite all her acclaim and success, this is what Maya Angelou feared. I have written 11 books, but each time I think, uh-oh, they're going to find out now. I've run a game on everybody, and they're going to find me out. You might be surprised to find out how many accomplished people think to themselves they'll be found out, then ostracized and ridiculed. However, it's irrational. It would only happen if you actually did have no skill, no ability, or no knowledge. But that isn't the case for most people. This is the ultimate fear, isn't it? Being found out and kicked out of our tribe? By nature, we're tribal. Humans survived through the millennia because we were part of a tribe that hunted, gathered, sheltered, and protected one another from the elements, from predators, and from other tribes. You couldn't be out hunting and watching the fire simultaneously. You needed other people if you had any hope of surviving through the night. If your tribe finds out you're a fraud, it triggers that primordial, uh-oh, they're going to kick me out. I'm going to be caught in the wilderness alone. When plagued by imposter syndrome, people don't take themselves, their abilities, or their accomplishments seriously. If you don't take yourself seriously on any field of play, you most likely won't be getting the results you want. Hidden Force 2, Personal Trauma. Some people have lived tough lives. They've lived through very traumatic events. It could have been living through a war or the death of a parent. It could have been the conditions they grew up in, like poverty, an abusive home, discrimination, if they were teased as kids, if they had a health issue, or if they lived through some other event that left an impression within them. Friedrich Nietzsche once wrote, "To live is to suffer. To survive is to find some meaning in the suffering." You can't heal emotional scars with an alter ego. However, you don't need to carry that weight with you everywhere you go. Not to ever dismiss away traumas, but the stories the enemy tells us about ourselves, about those events that we experience, often don't serve us. The enemy will blame you for bringing it on yourself or tell you people with your past can't overcome it. That story spinning inside is coming from the enemy. Take Javier, for example. Javier is a soccer player whose coach believed the best way to motivate his players was to yell and scream at them. For some of the men, it was what they needed. For Javier, not so much. Javier's father was an alcoholic, and he ran his home and his children like a drill sergeant. His father was an imposing man with a frightening temper who ruled through fear. Whenever Javier's coach yelled, instead of it being an injection of motivating energy, it triggered an emotional reaction connected to his personal history. Suddenly, those feelings of terror surfaced. Javier's past was getting in the way and causing his emotions to kick into overdrive and create a lot of mistakes and make a lot of fouls. To be clear, your personal history isn't the enemy. The enemy only uses past traumas against you if it can. People have things happen to them all the time that they would never want, but they use them to fuel their success. Later in the book, you'll meet people who have used past traumas as fuel by changing the meaning of those events, or they've created an alter ego from the ground up that doesn't battle with that history and can finally show up as they desire. Hidden Force 3, Tribal Narratives. This is one of the more powerful forces because it affects your thinking and behavior on your field of play from the core drivers. These are the deeper things you connect yourself to and the unconscious beliefs you've adopted because of prevailing narratives. The enemy is sneaky. It slips in unnoticed and attaches itself to stories about what a certain group of people can or can't do. It creates beliefs about who is worthy of achieving something, which you may have unwittingly adopted and now color the way you see the world and what's possible. If I grew up with a family narrative that said, "Hermans don't have money," or "Hermans are average people," then that thought and belief would impact my behavior, my performance, and my ideas of what's possible. The enemy, as a tribal narrative, can also be around your family. It's the narrative your family has told for generations. "We're not entrepreneurs" is something I hear from a lot of my business clients who are often the first ones in their families to start a business. Is this story true? No. Anyone can be an entrepreneur, but their enemy is weaving a tale based on their history and what they've experienced, and it's affecting the self that's showing up. A fantastic example of someone challenging the status quo is dancer Misty Copeland. She's an accomplished ballet dancer now and the first African-American to be named principal dancer at the famed American Ballet Theater. However, as she was developing as a dancer, there wasn't anyone who looked like her at the highest levels. Not only was she African-American in a predominantly white classical dance world, she was also more muscular than the classical petite frame the ballet world was used to. Fast forward to today, and she's now a celebrated ballerina for the American Ballet Theater, performing on the biggest stages in front of thousands of fans. She could have easily succumbed to the enemy telling her, African-Americans don't belong in that world. However, she chose differently and has inspired a whole new group of girls to dream big. I mentioned the need to be a part of a tribe when explaining the force of imposter syndrome. It's in our DNA. Imagine you were living like a caveman, with saber-toothed tigers and woolly mammoths roaming the land. Imagine you got booted from your tribe. You'd be on your own, forced to hunt, clothe yourself, and find shelter on your own. Who would protect you? We still cling to that desire to fit in, to find our tribes, and be accepted by them. One of the most influential tribes we're a part of is our family. I've seen many people battle the expectations of their family or the beliefs about what it means to be a good family member, and it's prevented them from leading the lives they've wanted. I come from a family that's incredibly close. My two brothers, sister, and my parents all live near my family's farm in Alberta, a farm that's been in our family for generations. I wish I lived closer to them, and my kids could know and be around their cousins more. I wish I could see my family more often, but I made conscious choices to build a life elsewhere. I chose New York City because I knew it would afford me more opportunities for career and professional growth. Even today, decades after leaving home, I still feel the enemy pull this string every so often. I still hear that nagging voice questioning why I left and what kind of son or brother leaves. Too often, the enemy causes us to become so concerned with upsetting the people closest to us that it impacts our decisions. It causes us to make choices counter to what's in the best interest of our careers, creative endeavors, and what we truly want. I can't tell you the number of people who, when we start to examine what's going on, turn out to be afraid of showing up as a heroic self. Why? Because they're afraid of success, and it causing them to leave their ordinary world and enter their extraordinary world, where their friends and family may not accept their new reality. They'll find themselves wandering in a desolate land, alone and lonely, with nobody there to support them. During an online training event, I was coaching a professor at New York University who previously taught at the University of North Carolina and Stanford. For 6 years, he'd been building a business on how to create better cultures aimed at business leaders. He created a formula and curriculum, and he was eager to work with companies in the New York metro area. He sees his extraordinary world clearly, but he hasn't been able to take that first step from the ordinary to the extraordinary. I have a full-time teaching schedule at the university, and launching this training company, I just don't have the time, and I can't go and hire someone to go and help me with this, he began to tell me. I stopped him. Wait, why can't you go and hire someone? Because if the professors in my discipline found out that I was getting someone else to research this program, then they're going to ridicule me. How do you know that's true? Will they? Well, he began, but I cut him short. You realize that this is what stops most university professors who've got smart stuff that their clients and customers would truly benefit from? You realize these thoughts and beliefs are what prevent people like you from ever launching something out into the broader world? You're thinking and worried about what all the other professors, the people in your tribe, think of you. But who cares what they think? They're not the people paying your paycheck. They're not the people who stand to benefit from your ideas and solutions. He just sat there staring at me. Almost every one of us is looking for approval from our peers, from the people we see and believe are our tribe. What about you? Does the third force trap you in any way? Family and peers are only a couple of the ways this enemy can keep you trapped. There are cultural, religious, racial, and gender-specific ideas people have rattling around in their heads too. That's only for those people. If I did that, my people would think I'm a sellout. The people at my church, mosque, synagogue, wouldn't like it if I did that. Only men can do that. Only women can do that. We're great at math and science, so I should be a doctor or engineer. Canadians are nice and never argue. I had to slip that one in there. The point is, there are many ways the enemy pushes you back from taking action on your goals and causes you to choose to stay trapped. But not for long. What happened to Rachel? Remember Rachel from earlier in the chapter? What was causing her to fall short on her field of play, the court? Why did the BLT sandwich suddenly make me realize what was causing the enemy to show up on the court? It was simple. She valued fairness. Rachel is one of the sweetest, most kind-hearted people I've ever met. However, when someone would cut in line at a coffee shop, it would drive her crazy. If she saw a homeless person on the street, she'd give them whatever she had to make their day more comfortable. She was extremely charitable. So you think, great, how could that be a problem? We need more people like that. I agree. However, there's a time and place for everything, and sports or competition isn't the field of play for being charitable. I immediately called her on it and said, Rachel, I think I finally cracked the nut on you. As we walked out the doors to the restaurant and stood on the corner of 31st Street and Lexington Avenue to talk, she said, what do you mean? So I asked, when you start beating someone handily and get way up on them, what do you start thinking or feeling about the other person? After a little back and forth to get clarity, she thought for a moment and said, do you really have to beat her so badly? Don't rub it in too much and make her look bad. Do you have to rub it in that you're better than her? Are you trying to embarrass her like some show-off? I would hate to lose this bad. And then what happens? That's when I let up. Exactly. And that's because you're bringing everyday life Rachel onto the court. The Rachel that values fairness and all people being treated equally. And it's causing you to let up. The only fairness that matters on the court is that you play by the rules of the sport, not whether or not you need to let someone lose by only a few points. There are winners and losers in competition, and your role is to give it your best and see which side you fall on. And right now, you're the one that's deciding someone shouldn't have the experience of embarrassment, humiliation, or failure, and you're robbing them of the opportunity to improve. Because those experiences often create the catalyst for change for someone. And that's not fair. You're giving them a false sense of how good they are. You need to use every ounce of your skill on that court. And if that ends up smashing someone, great. You've just given them a gift. She stood there for a moment, with taxis whizzing by and people rushing by us on the sidewalk, and finally said, I never thought of it that way. It makes so much sense. The everyday Rachel has a purpose, and the court Rachel needs a persona custom fitted to that environment. Precisely. There's nothing wrong with valuing equality. Except in the world of sports and competition, there's no place for it. Sportsmanship, sure, but someone has to lose. Fairness was such a core part of who she was that Rachel brought it with her onto the court, and it just sabotaged her performance. With Rachel, I never tried to talk her out of valuing fairness, nor did I tell her she needs to change her value. Instead, we created an alter ego who didn't carry her definition of fairness onto the field of play. Rachel's alter ego instead valued fierce competition and winning with honor, like a true champion sportswoman. So getting back to the enemy's forces, if you're not clear about what or who needs to be showing up on your field of play, you can end up carrying a trapped self onto that field that won't serve you. In the previous chapters, we used two of the five bridges of progress, stop and less of, at the field of play layer and action layer of the model. Now it's about applying this framework to the belief layer and core drivers layer to reveal any blocks and reveal any forces affecting your results. What do you want to stop believing? Stop thinking? Stop valuing? Stop projecting? Stop judging? Stop carrying the weight of some tribal narrative? Feel less of, think less of, worry less of, or doubt less of. If you think about any of the common or hidden forces, you could apply the stop or less of framework to any of them. Over the last few chapters, this act of identifying all the things you want to stop or less of in the way we thought, felt, acted, or experienced helped you get to this point, where you can get clear about the enemy and what might be currently trapping you in the ordinary. Without this clarity, it's hard to build a powerful alter ego, because you won't fully understand the vision or why behind it. That is why the fake it till you make it philosophy has fallen flat for so many people. Faking it until you're making it always carries with it the wrong intention. However, having a clear vision created from a deep desire for what you want in an extraordinary world activates a heroic self, something you feel truly represents who you are and what you're capable of achieving or creating. Conversely, the trapped self is only considered trapped because when you look at the results you're currently getting and who is showing up, it doesn't feel like the real you. Jung called it the shadow. We call it the enemy. And as I've shown with previous examples, it can be as simple as selecting the wrong traits to use at the wrong times. It's like the cowboy who brings a knife to a gunfight. On a different field of play, this version of yourself may be the best version you could bring forth, just like Rachel and her fantastic quality of valuing fairness. It's a bit of a mind bender for sure, but it's also what enables thinking about life through the lens of varying fields of play. Becoming your own coach. As a performance and mental game coach, my job is to hold up a mirror to the athletes and leaders I'm working with. My job is to get them to see their behaviors and understand the driving force behind how and why they're showing up in their moments of impact. What you've just done is take a closer look at each of the forces so that you can hold up your own mirror. For some people, this may feel slightly uncomfortable. Whenever I'm uncomfortable, I remind myself this is like reviewing game tape. Athletes watch film from practices and games to dissect their form and to find the areas they need to perfect and practice to ensure they show up as their best selves. That's all you're doing right now with these forces. You're looking at game tape, collecting intel, and gaining greater insight into why you may be showing up the way you are right now. You may want to read back through the forces and be curious. Adopt an air of discovery. Think to yourself, that's interesting. Allow yourself to be surprised by what you uncover. These suggestions involve using the intrinsic motivators inherent in all of us to look at your world with a better mindset. Sometimes the forces may overlap. You may read through the list going, yep, I got that one, and that one. Oh, and I definitely have that one too. You may find that only one resonates with you. You may even discover nothing hits. If you find yourself saying, Todd, I don't know where my thoughts, emotions, and behaviors are coming from, that's okay. Sometimes there isn't a common or a hidden force at work. Don't spend too much time rummaging around inside the dark cavern. If it's not there, it's not there. Be your own coach, and you'll do just fine. Never forget, the alter ego effect is something you inherently already know how to do. What if I asked you, what would Batman do? Or Ellen DeGeneres? Or James Bond? You'd automatically know how to play with the idea. Maybe not flawlessly, but you'd be able to play with those alter egos and show up slightly differently. With this audiobook, I'm just giving you more depth and firepower to turn this into an extremely powerful force for change. So if you're ready, let's put one last label on this enemy. Chapter 7. Pulling the Enemy from the Shadows. In 2009, Valeria Kuznetsova was a young rising star in the tennis world. She grew up in a small rural town, Kalinivka, outside of Kiev, Ukraine. Her little village was like most other small towns that dotted the Ukrainian countryside, except for one significant difference, which affected Valeria profoundly. It was filled with nothing but boys. And they were relentless. Her older brother, Dmitry, tried to shield her from the teasing, but even he got in on it sometimes too. They'd tease her about being a girl, about her skinny frame, and about pretty much anything. The worst of it was when they wouldn't let her play their games. No soccer because she was little, no basketball because she was too weak, no rugby because she was a girl. Not to be discouraged, she'd fight her way into the games anyway. Then she'd make a mistake, and they'd banish her from the field or court. One day, after yet another expulsion from a game, she ran home crying to her Tato, Dad, and shouted to him, "The boys were being mean again." He got up from his chair, walked over to the closet, grabbed a tennis racket and ball, handed it to her and said, "Go out back and hit that ball against the garage 100 times. Angry that he wasn't going to help her yell at the boys, she snatched the racket and ball out of his hand, stomped outside and began smashing the ball into the side of the house, muttering under her breath how much she hated Vlad, Sergey, Alexander, Sasha, and especially Igor, the meanest of the bunch. 12 years later, she had transformed herself into one of the top up-and-coming tennis players in the world. She used that anger, humiliation, and rage to rocket herself through the tennis ranks and into the elite of the sport. But there was a problem. When I got the call from her coach to come out to Flushing Meadows in Queens, New York, there was a panic in his voice. He knew he had this great talent in front of him, but he saw her melting into her mental distress any time she began making unforced errors or mistakes. When I arrived, Valeria was getting ready to start her match against a much lower-ranked player. The match started off with Valeria overpowering her opponent, but then, as we say in the sports world, the wheels came off. The moment she started making even minor mistakes, you could see her pace and mutter under her breath. And the more the mistakes piled up, the more agitated and animated she'd get. After the match was over, which she managed to win, we met back at her hotel for a chat to see if we'd be a good fit. I asked her about what she was saying to herself when she was pacing the baseline. Her first reaction was a look of surprise, then embarrassment. You could see that? You could see me talking to myself? I chuckled and said, "Of course, but don't think it's a bad thing. We all talk to ourselves. It's just a matter of how constructive that conversation is to our ability to perform and do better. Multiple studies have been done on the power of talking to yourself, and in fact, it improves your performance. A study published in Adolescence in 1994, titled Private Speech in Adolescence, showed that narrating the process of what you're doing improves your performance. However, there's another side of the equation. What happens when your self-talk isn't so positive? Valeria went on to tell me how she would say things like, "Get in the game. Use your head. Stop forcing it. Stop being so stupid. Not this again." Or she would ask herself questions like, "What are you doing? Why are you letting her back in the game? Why can't you just settle down?" Maybe you can relate. You see, Valeria had fallen into the trap of having a circular, bullying conversation in her head, what I call the merry-go-round effect. A conversation that goes nowhere, beats yourself up, and only spirals you into more and more self-defeating chatter. However, because our minds love to create a story and make us the hero of it, the solution is to give yourself an enemy to talk to when those seeds of negative self-talk show up. We go from an internal merry-go-round of negativity to a constructive back and forth, allowing us to shove the enemy to the sidelines. When I explained this nuance to Valeria, she immediately relaxed, tipped her head back and said, "Igor," with gritted teeth. Then she explained her entire backstory to me, about where she grew up, the boys in town, and all the verbal barbs they threw her way, and how she stood at the side of her family's house, smashing the ball into the side of it, muttering the names of her bullies under her breath. Igor became the label she placed on the forces the enemy would use to try to trap her and pull her into an ordinary world by getting her angry or frustrated. Instead of adding more emotion to her already intense personality, we took Igor, shrank that negative self-talk down to the size of an annoying pest of an 8-year-old bully, and shoved him to the sidelines. Valeria's anger and intensity had gotten her into the pros, but it was going to keep her from winning championships. She was going to burn out. So we flipped what had now become a hidden force, past history, hurting her performance, and dealt with it by shrinking its size. Naming your enemy creates a compelling distinction between the two worlds living inside all of us, the ordinary and the extraordinary. It allows your heroic self to talk back to the enemy trying to trap you. The problem with the unseen and unnamed. When you think about the scariest movies you've ever seen, was the killer or monster revealed immediately? Probably not. Because when something lurks in the shadows, when you can't see, touch, or hold it, it becomes more frightening. It's unknown. And when something is unknown, it's difficult to deal with because your imagination runs wild, building it up to be larger than it is. The proverbial monster under the bed. Take the movie Jaws, for example. Originally, Steven Spielberg intended the huge mechanical shark to play a far more significant role in the film. But it broke, so he and his crew had to use other tricks to build the suspense. Remember the music? A deep beat begins to build. You know, something is coming, something from the vast depths beneath the water. But you don't know when or where or whom it will strike. No one saw the shark. You just see a girl splashing around and then suddenly getting pulled under the water. Talk about terrifying. By not seeing the enemy, Spielberg knew that he would trigger our imaginations to run wild. The imagination is a powerful tool, which we'll intentionally use to build your alter ego. But like all great tools, it can be wielded for positive or negative results. Sometimes your imagination, when not adequately harnessed or controlled, will run amok, filling in and creating an even more terrifying story. How big is this thing? I don't know, but it must be huge. The more something remains in the shadows, in the dark, unseen and untouched, the scarier it becomes. In the last section, we began to shine a light on the enemy and its forces. Now I want you to drag it from the shadows and give it a name. That's right. I want you to name your enemy. As soon as you give something a name, you've given it an identity. You've given it a form, a shape, a structure. When we give something a shape, we are also giving our alter ego something to defeat, something to overcome, something to battle against. Let me show you what I mean. When I say the names the Joker, Darth Vader, or even Saddam Hussein, what did you see? I bet a picture instantaneously popped into your head, as automatic as breathing. And along with that image or thought, you may have even felt a specific emotion. This is the power of giving something a name. Giving it a name and giving it a form allows you to talk to the enemy, get it off your field of play, and give it a swift kick to the sidelines. I'll show you how later in the book. You can choose any name. A lot of this depends on your personality and what makes sense to you. You can make it silly, make it scary, make it something that ignites your anger or rage, or something that used to scare you but doesn't anymore, like Valeria did with Igor. Or simply give it a plain old name like Michael, Sarah, Jesse, Tony, or Hans. A word of caution around an enemy that brings on anger and rage. These can be great focusers for athletes. I've had Olympians and pro athletes channel rage during competition and then play with it beautifully. Unlike a lot of self-help books that preach peace and tranquility as the pathway to performance, I tell people that rage and anger can activate peak performance. However, make sure they suit your field of play. The bottom line, make it something you're going to love facing down and conquering. What do I mean? Humiliate it. Make the enemy as small as possible. Make it cute. Make it something that you'll look at and go, "Aw, aren't you adorable?" Take away all its fear over you. Make it the most non-threatening thing you've ever seen. Make it a puppy and call it Scooby-Doo. Call it Fluffy or Pippi. Only make it Darth Vader if it's to remember that Darth Vader is a bald actor in an uncomfortable suit. Now, if you're someone who thrives on conflict, who needs a challenge in life to test your mettle and bring out your grit, then do the opposite. Make the enemy fierce. Make it scary. Make it intense. Pick the name of your childhood bully or a boss you detested. Pick a family member who has tried to hold you back or told you you'd never amount to anything. I've even had clients pick a parent as their enemy. Truly, anything goes. Whether you make the enemy funny, silly, harmless, or intimidating, scary, or challenging, give it a name. It makes it easier for your imagination to give it form and substance. You can also pick a character from a book, television show, movie, or comic in which someone else has gone through the trouble of developing lots of details about this person. You're looking to get as detailed as you can so that it will make visualizing the enemy easier for you. The more vivid your enemy, the easier it will be for your alter ego to drive it from your moment of impact. If you decide to pick something like an animal, you could simply use wolf, or give the wolf a name like Cristobal. It's the difference between saying, "Hey wolf, step to the sidelines because you don't want this fight," and saying, "Hey Cristobal, this is my time, I'm not ruled by you anymore, bugger off." If you're stuck on a name. If you can't figure out what to name your enemy right now, wait. Many clients have to build their alter ego first, and then they pick something or someone that is their alter ego's natural enemy. They'll also pick something and name it someone they know without a doubt their alter ego can and will easily defeat. So, if you aren't inspired right now, wait and then come back. Build your alter ego's origin story, then fill in the enemy's name. Get all the way to the response proclamation and then come back. Remember, there's no perfect order to any of this. You name the enemy when the enemy is clear to you. Chapter 8. The Power of Your Story. After my presentation to a room filled with Army Green Berets and Rangers, I walked off the 2-foot-high stage to greet a few people with questions for me. After I talked to a few of the Rangers about superheroes and comic book villains, a colonel tapped me on the shoulder and asked me if we could have a private conversation. I said, "Of course." Together we walked out of the auditorium at the Fort Bragg military base in North Carolina, the world's largest military installation. Fort Bragg is home to the United States Army Special Operations Command, which is responsible for training, equipping, and deploying special forces around the world for their various missions. Judging by the lines around the colonel's eyes, I was facing a hardened professional who had spent a lot of time squinting through binoculars or the scope of a gun and could tell me stories for days. "First, I want to thank you for coming and spending some time with our men and women. We appreciate it," he started. "The one thing I've always appreciated about speaking to military crowds, whether they're elite Navy SEALs or fresh-faced recruits, is that everyone is extremely gracious to a civilian like me, and they always refer to a larger we. It's always an honor to come and share and hopefully make a difference," I said. "You said something interesting in there that I wanted to discuss with you." "Sure." "You mentioned the meaning of the uniform we all wear and how different uniforms mean different things. And if we're not careful, those meanings can either help us or hurt us. I realized something at that moment. This uniform isn't helping me." "What do you mean?" I asked. "When I put this thing on, it means something to me. I love wearing the flag on my sleeve. I love serving, and I love training these men and women, which means I have to be tough, challenging, and strong. We talk about honor, code, and the chain of command all the time, but I just realized it's been hurting my kids. Every day I get home and the kids want to spend time with me, and I immediately start grilling them about homework and chores. Even after I get changed out of my uniform, I'm still the same person. I've been racking my brain for the past 20 minutes trying to figure out how to apply what you talked about. Colonel, since the founding of the nation, the military has been building a history, story, and credo of what it means to wear that uniform. Are there handbooks everywhere on the base about what it means to be in the U.S. Army?" "Yes." "Well, your story is pretty similar to what most people around you tell themselves about the uniform, give or take a few details. It's reinforced through repetition and an environment built to support it. But where on the base, or anywhere else for that matter, do you go to get your dad uniform? Where's the handbook about the history, story, and credo of what it means to join the Brotherhood of Fatherhood? When you go home and change out of your uniform, do your jeans and golf shirt mean anything to you? Probably not. When you pay attention, you realize you're a natural storytelling machine. Every day, you're telling yourself a story in your head filled with a colorful narrative about life. You're also listening to other people tell you their personal stories. And you're sucking up story after story from social media to television to print. In her book, Wired for Story, Lisa Cron dissects the latest in brain science to teach writers how to tell stories that pull their readers in and keep them flipping the pages. As Cron explains, we think in story. It's hardwired in our brain. It's how we make strategic sense of the otherwise overwhelming world around us. Right now, whether you realize it or not, you're living out a powerful story. Sometimes it's a story you've created over time, telling yourself why you can, can't, do, don't, should, shouldn't, show up in a particular way on the many fields of play of your life. Other times, there are potent narratives built into the world you live in, just like the kernel. They're often ideas we've unconsciously adopted from any of the core driver's layer, which could be family, religion, country, gender, race, or a group you're a part of. Occasionally, we become slave to a story we didn't even realize we accepted. What do you think of when you hear the following words? Shy, saleswoman, fistfight, clutch player, gossip, scientist, investing, cooking, flying, long lines, winner. When you heard the word shy, did you automatically think of its literal definition? Nervous or timid in the company of other people? From the Oxford Dictionary online? Or did you think of someone you know who's shy? Or did you think of an entirely different meaning or story around the word shy? What about the other words? We all have reactions to different words, either positive, negative, or indifferent. I was talking with an entrepreneur who told me, I really want to grow my network, but I avoid people in social situations because I'm shy and introverted. The story she told herself was, only outgoing extroverted people are good at meeting people. Shy and introverted people can't. The problem, I know a ton of shy and introverted people who are outstanding at networking. Yes, there was a part of herself that was shy and introverted, but being shy and introverted aren't negatives unless you make them negatives. She was losing out in her business world because she wasn't showing up with confidence. To succeed, she needed to cease being shy about selling her products and services. She needed to stop telling herself a story that said, I am shy and introverted, so I can't network. Now here's one of the benefits of the alter ego effect. Instead of trying to go on the long road of changing herself, she could step into an alter ego that isn't shy. This bypasses a common force that prevents people from achieving their goals, being more intentional about who needs to show up. These narratives or stories we're telling ourselves are important because unconscious ideas and emotion drive action. Each of us is driven more by our gut feelings than our thoughts. Marketers and advertisers deeply understand the connection that emotion has on driving our actions to buy a product or service to satisfy a want. These masters of emotion know that the fastest way to get someone to buy from them is to tell a compelling story. Seth Godin, one of the leading thinkers on marketing, says, "The reason all successful marketers tell stories is that consumers insist on it. Consumers are used to telling stories to themselves and telling stories to each other, and it's just natural to buy stuff from someone who's telling us a story." Godin's book, All Marketers Are Liars, discusses the idea that everyone is a liar. Godin writes, "We tell ourselves stories that can't possibly be true, but believing those stories allows us to function." There is perhaps no faster way to evoke a strong emotion than to tell or hear a compelling story. We feel stories, and when we feel stories, whether we're feeling fear, anxiety, joy, or happiness, those emotions can prompt us to act. When we're telling ourselves powerful negative stories wrapped up in a hidden force, then they become self-fulfilling prophecies. Imagine for a moment that 5 minutes before a big meeting with a prospective client, a script began playing internally. The script went like this. I'll never close this prospective client. He's way more successful than me. I don't have anything worth selling. They're so much better than me. I'm such an imposter. They're going to realize I don't belong in this room with them. When that's the story you're telling yourself about you, it's pretty hard to walk into that meeting relaxed, confident, and self-assured that you have an incredible opportunity to offer the person across from you, and they'd be lucky to work with a partner like you. You're crossing wires. It's challenging to tell such a demoralizing story and then go